I think we can start. And really, it's a pleasure to welcome back Dr. Reinhold. When we first spoke, we said we'd do a two-part series on introduction to medieval and modern philosophy. But then I thought, why not, even though I know it's a little, we're getting closer to Pesach, figured a good philosophical topic, the issues of free will and God's foreknowledge, and obviously that ties into Pesach. So it's a pleasure and an honor to have Dr. Reinhold back with us. And Dr. Shah, we'll let you take it away. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robert Kelman. And thank you, everybody who is here, given that we're only a few days away from Pesach now. So, you know, thank you for choosing to join me this evening. Or did you? That's our question. You see, on the one hand, you all believe that you decided of your own free will to tune in tonight for this talk. But of course, there are a couple of challenges to that. One of them is a relatively modern challenge, and one of them is a long-standing one. And it's that challenge that I'm interested in exploring with you tonight. And we're going to look at a couple of solutions, one of which doesn't work, one of which may or may not, but it's certainly not a mainstream solution, even though it's one put forward by one of the Rishonim. And just to, you know, explore some of the interesting issues that arise out of this. Of course, Pesach primarily, I suppose, is about freedom in the more political sense, right? In the sense that we were enslaved. And of course, this is Mancheh Rutenu. This is the point at which we are no longer enslaved. And there are all kinds of actually very interesting questions in political thought regarding, you know, the nature of freedom from that perspective. But our question tonight is a little bit more, without wishing to put people off with big words, metaphysical, because we're looking at this kind of whole question of the extent to which human beings who all on the whole believe we are free. And there is this long-standing philosophical challenge as to whether or not that's actually the case. I still recall when I was a first-year philosophy undergraduate, our introduction to philosophy course picked on two issues, and one of them was this one, right, the question of free will. So we're going to explore that a little bit tonight, and we'll just begin with the intuitive notion or the intuitive question, which is this conflict or apparent conflict between free will on the one hand and on the other, some form of what we call determinism. Okay. And determinism is the idea that there is one set future, shall we say. You see, to go back to my very beginning point, everybody feels as if they made a choice whether to be sat there at your computer terminal this evening and whether to, you know, turn off in 5 minutes, should you wish to. And the question is whether that's the case. Free will, intuitively, we think of in terms of this garden of forking paths. So, you know, we are here at this point and I now have a forking path, right? I could do A, I could do B. That's actually more limiting than it probably is. You could do any number of things right now, should you so desire. And we really do think, I think intuitively, like I say, of freedom as the ability to do otherwise, right? That intuitively, that's how we think of it. I did A, but I could have done B. I'm here listening to this, but I could have been elsewhere. I could be, you know, admittedly, the things you could have been doing right now are more limited than they usually are because, you know, couldn't have been out at restaurants, etc. But, you know, there's still plenty of things you could have done. And that's how we generally see freedom, the ability to do otherwise, right? Something other than what we chose to do. Fine. The two challenges to that, one of them is more scientific, I suppose. And that's the idea that certain people within contemporary science would put forward. Every act that we do, or every event is simply a function of its causes, right? So human beings, as you know, material beings, right? We're made up of the same stuff as everything else, all of which are subject to the same scientific laws as anything else, and therefore everything is caused by its prior cause, right? Everything is an effect of a cause, which in itself is the effect of a cause, which in itself is the effect of a cause, etc., 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 all the way back to the beginning of time, such that there's no such thing as free will. We certainly feel as if we could have done something other than we did, but the scientific challenge is that actually, no, everything is determined by its prior causes. Now, that's admittedly, it's a challenge. There are answers to it, but it's not the challenge we're going to look at tonight. We will actually kind of tangentially look at that challenge, but our main challenge is the more theological one. As mentioned, right, this is the time of freedom, and we can even speak in terms of our challenge tonight, because God famously tells Abraham that we're going to be enslaved, the Israelites or his descendants at any rate will be enslaved in Egypt for 400 years. There are all kinds of questions regarding that particular number and the calculations and whether it was or whether it wasn't, and you know, likely it wasn't, but depends how you count it. But nonetheless, the fact is God predicts, because God knows. But if God knows and predicts, then to what extent can we escape that prediction? Now, the classic kind of pithy answer to that is something that we find in as early as the Mishnah. I'm going to now share, so I'm hoping you're going to see this. Yes, do we all see? Well, that's fantastic. So there you go, the famous Mishnah in Avot, HaKol Safoi V'Arashot Nutana. Right, the important piece for us there is simply the first two clauses. Everything is seen, and free will is given. So this is simply a statement that, well, everything's foreseen, right? God sees everything, but that doesn't rule out the fact that you're free. Problem is, it seems to us that it might do. Because many people would argue as follows, which is, let's take it that this time last week, right, this time last week, God knew that each one of you would be sat wherever you are now sat, listening to this session, right? God knew that last week. Now, God is omniscient. God is meant to know all truths that can be known. And therefore, last week, his knowing that you would be here now, the content of his knowledge has to be true. I mean, God doesn't make errors. God doesn't make mistakes. So it must be, we'll stop sharing for a moment, it must be that what God knew last week would indeed turn out to be the case. But of course, that means that the fact you're sitting here right now could not have been otherwise. However you may feel, right, we all feel as if we made a choice here. But if God knew last week you'd be sitting here now, how on earth could you possibly not be sitting here right now? Could you have genuinely chosen to do anything else? Well, if so, you'd have proven God wrong. God doesn't get things wrong. And of course, you can always try and, you know, get out of this and say, well, you know, I could have left at the last minute. True, but then God would have known last week, not that you would be here, but he would have known you were going to change your mind at the last minute, and that would have been the thing that was determined. So the problem here, as you know, as generally put out there, is this problem of divine omniscience. If God knows what is going to be, and he knows whatever it is human beings are going to do, then that seems like it's a threat to our intuitive notion of free will, where that intuitive notion, as I said, is our ability to do something other than what we did. Just have to, my dog is here and wants to go out the room. Off you go. My apologies. So this is our challenge. Now there's an immediate response to that, a response that many people often give, and it's a response actually given by Sadia Gaon. So Sadyaga On, the great both medieval Jewish systematic theologian, Emunot V'Dayot, his famous work was the first major work of medieval Jewish philosophy. We mentioned it a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, many other things as well. He was a Hebrew grammarian. He was the name Gaon, right, was because he was one of the Geonim, as in one of the heads of the famous rabbinical academies of Surah Pumpadita, of what we now call Iraq, but Babylonia back then. He lived from the year 882 to 942, and, you know, was a really major figure in Jewry in that period, end of the 9th, mainly into the 10th century. And in Emunot V'Dayot, he gives us his response to this problem. And like I say, it's one that many people come up with when presented with the question. So we're going to go back to our source sheet and have a look at what Sadia had to say about this. And what Sadia had to say is as follows. It's in English here. Sadia wrote the work in Arabic. And the translation is as follows. Right? Let's have a look at what Sadia says together. He writes, "Furthermore, one might perhaps also say, inasmuch as God knows what is to be before it happens, he must also know that man will rebel against him. But in that case, it would be impossible for man not to rebel, since otherwise what God foreknows would not be realized." Now, that's just a statement of the problem as we discussed just before outside of the text, right? It's saying, look, God knows in advance you're going to rebel, then you would have clearly you had no choice but to rebel. In a sense, this is a fairness and justice thing. How can God punish you for rebelling against God if you could do nothing other than rebel since he knew you were going to, right? And here's his solution in the second half of that quote. "The resolution of this doubt, however, is more obvious than even that of the first one." He had a previous doubt that he's already dispensed with. This one he thinks is easier. "It need not be pointed out," writes Sadia, "that the person who makes the above-mentioned assertion is really unable to prove that the Creator's foreknowledge of things is the cause of their coming into being. His assertion is therefore nothing else than an erroneous assumption or, and that should say, deliberate invention." All right. Apologies for the typo, which I can fill in as I sit here. Oh, the wonders of Zoom. So the resolution of the doubt. What is Sadia's response to the question? And as I say, it's one that many people might even have thought of themselves, which is, look, I get that God knows I was going to be here. Fine. But that doesn't mean he was causing me to be here, right? That doesn't mean he was kind of controlling my every action, right? He knew something that would be, right? It's I might be able to predict something true about tomorrow, right? I believe it's going to be sunny, right? So let's say I now say it's going to be sunny tomorrow, and it's true that it's sunny tomorrow. I didn't make that happen. Just because I got it right, doesn't mean that I in any way made it or caused it to happen. And this is Sadia's initial solution, right? Yes, God knew you were going to be here last week at this time, but he didn't make it happen. He didn't causally control you. Like, I mean, in my day when we played computer games, it was joysticks, right? So imagine you kind of, you know, God controlling you. Nowadays, you'd probably be a finger on an iPad or something, right? But the idea would be that, look, God's not doing that, right? He's not controlling your every movement by somehow manipulating everything you do. Just because he knows you're going to do something doesn't mean he's caused you to do it, right? This is Sadia's solution. Is it a good one? All right, does this solution work? Well, I don't know if anybody actually out there has any ideas on that. If anybody wishes to raise any objections to it, or if everybody's satisfied with it, then please feel free to jot it down in the chat or say so. But I have to say, to me, it doesn't sound like a very compelling solution. And the reason it's not a compelling solution, we can make clear in a number of ways, right? But the way I'm going to kind of begin is with what philosophers like to call a thought experiment, okay? So I would like you to all imagine, right? It's actually very difficult to really imagine this, right? To concretely think of a world that is this way, right? But for the sake of argument, imagine that the scientists were wrong, right? Imagine that our acts were not in any way causally determined, right? Imagine the laws of cause and effect just didn't apply to human beings at all, right? So it wasn't, there's a cause and an effect of action, but we're completely and utterly free, okay? Just seeing here, very nice. We have an alternative solution. We'll come back to that one. All right. But for the moment, right, let's stick with Sadhya's for the moment and see if and how it might or might not work. So imagine, like I say, human beings are not determined by a bunch of causes, right? If that were the case, would God still know that you were going to be here this week? Would he have known that? Even if there was no such thing as causation in the world, right? The reason that we can predict anything is because of causation, right? If I do something really simple, here's a pen, right? I'm going to let go of this pen now, right? What's going to happen to it, right? I imagine you all would say, well, it's going to drop, it's going to fall, right? And the reason you say that is laws of cause and effect, right? You can predict the way the world's going to go pretty well. There you go, right? Not a trick question. It fell, right? Laws of gravity, cause and effect. The reason we can predict things is because of the laws of cause and effect, right? So maybe that's the way God works. So I want you to imagine that cause and effect were ineffective, right? You don't have cause and effect. You don't have that working in our world. Now, that would make it impossible for us to know what was going to happen next. I would do this and you would not have a clue what would happen if I let go of it, right? If the word world were not causally working in accordance with science, you would not have a clue what would happen. Could go off on the side, could rise, right? Could fall, who knows? We know because of the laws of science, right? Fine. So imagine no laws of science. We would be helpless. Would God be helpless? Now, presumably not, right? I mean, we presume God's omniscient. He knows what's going to be. And it's not simply because, you know, God isn't hanging on every event in the world. He's not wondering, oh, what's going to happen? Let me follow the laws of cause and effect. Let me see, right? We think God just knows, right? God would surely know what would be. And he's not sitting up there calculating, oh, it's cause and effect, right? When they predict the weather, meteorology, right? If God knows what the weather's going to be tomorrow, it's not because he spent a lot of time calculating all the meteorological stuff, right? God's knowledge is not like our knowledge. It's not just following what's going on, right? That would make it entirely dependent on us, right? So we think that God could know even if there were no cause and effect, right? So let's return to Sadhya. Sadhya says, it's not a problem. God knows, you're still free. Because just because God knows doesn't mean he's making you do it. And I agree with that. I think that's true. Just because God knows doesn't mean he's making you do it. True. But so what? The problem's still there. It doesn't matter whether God made you sit there, whether God, so to, you know, kivyachol, takes his hand, right, and sat you down there tonight. Doesn't matter. Because whatever the truth is, even if there's no cause and effect, even if there was no such thing going on, last week God knew something. And what God knew was true. And therefore, there was nothing else you could have done right now. You could not have chose to do something else. Therefore, you're not free. Okay, the causation thing's a red herring. It's mixing up two different issues. Issue one, causation. Scientific determinism. Is that a threat to free will? Maybe. But even if it's not, imagine the world's not scientifically determined. Imagine there's no cause guaranteeing you were going to be sat here tonight. It wouldn't matter. God would still know. And God's mere knowledge of something being the case means it has to be. So Sadia's solution doesn't really seem to solve our problem, right? Sadia's solution seems to almost conflate two different problems. The problem of cause and effect, real problem, and the problem of divine foreknowledge, real problem. But two separate problems with two separate solutions. And answering one of them doesn't answer the other. Sadia thinks God isn't making us sit here right now by forcing us literally. True. But still doesn't matter. Still means that last week, and by the way, obviously I've chosen last week because it's convenient. Truth is, God has known for all eternity that you were going to be sat here tonight. So it's not just a problem of last week. This has been determined since the beginning of time, which is a thought that concerns many people, right? Everything you've done has been determined for all of eternity. This is of some concern to us, maybe. So the problem is still in play. And the question is what we're going to do about it. Okay. And what we're going to look at here is a very famous solution. And I see in some of the comments that kind of, one of the solutions has actually kind of overlays ours, and therefore we'll come back to those comments towards the end. But we're going to look at a very famous solution that, before we get into it, I should say, it's a solution given by the Ralbag, right? Rabbi Levi ben Gershon. Now, Rabbi Levi ben Gershon, the Ralbag, Gersonides, he lives already, a good, about 300 years after Sadia, right? 1288 to 1344. And he lived in Provence, southern France. And he's one of the last of the, really great medieval Jewish philosophers. He wrote a book, a philosophical book called Milchamot Hashem, The Wars of the Lord. And within that work, he took certain stances that were controversial. And by controversial, I simply mean not the mainstream views that are held within Orthodox Judaism. Right now, he's the Ralbag. This is not to impugn his own, rabbinic adherence, but it wasn't a standard view, even at the time. Right. I actually think it's a really interesting one, and we'll explore that. Right. But it's a view. There are others. One of them is in the comments, and we're going to come back and consider that as well. But the fact is, this was a view that was given. And even in his day, it was controversial. It was his book, Milchamot Hashem, Wars of the Lord, was once called by a critic of his Milchamot Im Hashem, Wars with the Lord, because they thought that some of the views therein, this one in particular, was so controversial as to be unacceptable. And therefore, this work of Jewish philosophy is actually a war on God rather than a war for or on his behalf. So I just preface what I'm saying with that, because this is a view of one of the great Rishonim, right? Ralbag, he has a very well-known parish on the Torah, right? More than the Torah, the whole Tanakh, although we don't have all of it. But his parish on the Torah is well-known, much studied, was in early versions of Mikra Gedolot. So this is not a kind of a flaky marginal figure we're talking about, right? This is a very significant figure. But at the same time, just to say that his philosophical work, somewhat like the Rambam, right, was not as warmly welcomed as, say, his parish on the Torah, even though the two of them are almost entirely consistent with each other, including on this particular case. So let us have a look at the view that that the Ralbag gives us, Okay, by the way, something else about the Rob Bug you should know, just because I always say when I teach this to students, I always tell them if there is one thing you will always remember about the Rob Bug, it's this, if you remember nothing else I say, right? And that is the Rob Bug has a crater on the moon named after him, right? The Rob Bug was a great astronomer. He actually created an instrument for measuring planetary distances that was called Jacob's Ladder. And therefore, there is a crater on the moon named after him. It's called Rabbi Levi, right? He's not the only one. Ibn Ezra's got one too, right? So there are two rabbinically named craters on the moon, Rabbi Levi, one of them. So there you go. Even if you do not recall anything about his views on free will on Nusians, you will always know, crater on the moon. So here we go. Ralbug, by the way, also Ralbug, the first really majorly significant work in Jewish philosophy written in Hebrew. Right? Up to this point, all the works are written in, all the really significant works that we still read were written in either in Arabic or in Judeo-Arabic. Judeo-Arabic is Arabic, but using Hebrew characters. So we use, you know, our alphabet, the alphabet, but writing Arabic words, right? So the Rambam wrote in Judeo-Arabic, Sadia wrote in Arabic, Yehuda Levi wrote in Arabic, but this is the point at which we switch and we actually get medieval Hebrew, okay? So the Hebrew is there, but for the sake of time, we'll just go straight down to the translation below, in part because there's some explaining that will need to be done. And here, the Ralbug speaks of our issue. Now, what I'm going to tell you here about Ralbug, by the way, is a tiny element of his discussion of divine knowledge, right? So this whole book of Milchamot Hashem, it's book three, Milchamot Hashem, the Wars of the Lord, is split into six books. The six books, it was occasioned by Rambam's Guide of the Perplexed. It was initially going to be all about creation. But when Ralbug wrote this lengthy work on creation, he found other things in the Rambam with which he was dissatisfied. So Milchamot Hashem is basically Ralbug writing on the issues that he felt the Rambam's philosophy had not dealt with correctly or sufficiently. And each book, therefore, deals with a different aspect of Rambam's philosophy, and tries to, whether it, you know, disagree, improve, further explicate, certainly to supplement. And divine knowledge, this is one of them. So he's talking here about divine knowledge in general. We're just going to look at one tiny element of it, right? Which is that which deals with our question, right? So let's have a look. He writes here, it has been previously shown that these particulars are ordered and determined in one sense, yet contingent in another sense. Now let's just pause so that we understand all the language. Particular is a philosophical term of art, right? All it means are, you know, things, particular things, right? This is a particular pen. This is another particular pen. Here are two particular pens, right? The world is made up of particulars. Right. Now, there are also general things. There's the idea of pen, right? There's a general idea of pen. And then we find lots of actual or particular pens. Here are two of them, right? So the word particular is simply the philosophical term of art that, to refer to individual things or individual events, right? So what's happening right now, this is a particular shear. This is a particular moment in a particular shir, right? Given by a particular person, right? This is just the terminology he uses. And Ralbug begins here by saying that particulars, by which he means here, particular human actions, right? That is our focus now. The things that we do, right? Every particular thing that we do. And he starts off, it's been shown these particulars are ordered and determined in one sense, yet contingent in another sense. So he starts off by saying human actions, there's a sense in which they are ordered and determined. Let's take a simple, uncontroversial example for the moment. You're all sitting there and none of you are rising off your chair. I don't mean standing up. I mean literally levitating. Right. Why is that? Well, because there are certain things about you that are ordered and determined, right? The same reason that the pen fell when I let go of it is the reason that you're stuck there sat in your chair. Gravity, right? There are things about you that are ordered and determined. And that's neither controversial nor threatening to us and our free will, I presume. But then he says there's another sense in which they are contingent. The word contingent here simply means, actually means dependent, right? But a contingency is something that is the case but doesn't have to be, right? So the fact you're here tonight, if we believe in free will, is a contingent matter. You are, but you might have decided to do something else, right? It's not a necessary feature of the universe that you're sat here. It's contingent. You did one thing, could have done another, depended on the decision you made. It was dependent. This will become clearer as we go through. He goes on, accordingly, it's evident that the sense in which God knows these particulars is the sense in which they are ordered and determined, as is the case with the agent intellect, according to the results previously established. Now, we're going to completely bypass all the agent intellect stuff, right? It will take us far too long, and it's a technical aspect of medieval thought. But all we need to know is that he tells us God knows particulars in the sense in which they are ordered and determined, and goes on, for from this aspect, it's possible to have knowledge of them. Okay. There is a sense in which things follow an order, and we can know about things in as much as they follow that order. With Roald Bug, he actually believed in astrology. Most of the medievals did. And therefore, the sense in which he thinks that things are ordered and determined is very much to do with astral determination. If you are born under, you know, the sign of whatever it is, I don't really know my astrology, but if you're born under that sign on a certain day where the planet Venus is in the whatever position, right, you are likely to be the kind of person who has a, let's say, a quick temper. Let's put it that way, right? And therefore, you know, you're quick-tempered. That's what you are. And you are very likely to be quick-tempered in any situation in which somebody who is quick-tempered will get angry and somebody who isn't won't, right? We needn't really, you know, worry too much about the astrological side of it. Nowadays, we could talk about genetics, right? That people are genetically predisposed maybe to have certain characteristics that might allow us to predict the likelihood they will do certain things. That's what he's talking about here, right? Roald Bug is saying people do have certain characters. Those characters for him are determined by various astrological aspects of the universe, which God has put in for good reason, the same reason he's put in the laws of gravity, right? And that allows God to predict, to know what it is certain people of a certain type will do, right? But he goes on, line four here, on the other hand, the sense in which God does not know particulars is the sense in which they are not ordered. That is the sense in which they are contingent. For in the latter sense, knowledge of them is not possible. However, God does know from this aspect that these events may not occur because of the choice which he has given man to compensate for the deficiencies in the supervision coming from the heavenly bodies, as has been explained in book two. So I've just said heavenly bodies determine what we do, right? But his point there is they don't completely and utterly determine what we do, because Roald Bug believes God has given us choice. As in, we can overcome our character, our astral determinants. God has given us the power to choose. God has given us the power to subvert a prediction, right? So you might think, well, he's the kind of guy who will obviously get really angry when, you know, whatever happens. And then he doesn't, right? Why? Well, because he manages to overcome it, right? He's not a robot, not completely determined. We have choice, right? That's Roald Bug clearly saying God gave us the choice, right? But the point being, he's saying God therefore doesn't know about what we're going to do from that perspective. Let us continue. We're down here after book two. Hopefully, if you see my cursor, you can see where we are. But he does not know which of the contradictory outcomes will be realized insofar as they are genuinely contingent affairs. For if he did, there would not be any contingency at all. Right? Okay, so this is very strong. Ralbug is saying, inasmuch as you have genuine freedom, you can genuinely choose to subvert your astral determinants, right? To the extent that's true, God does not know the choice you're going to make. Okay, just look at it again. He does not know, right? He, capital H, God. He does not know which of the contradictory outcomes will be realized insofar as they are genuinely contingent affairs. If he did, there would not be any contingency at all. Right? God can't know. If you're free, God cannot know. Because if he knew, you're not free. There's no contingency. Our starting point, right? If he knew you were going to be here tonight, you were going to be here tonight. Nothing you do about it. Ralbug seems to be saying, last week, God did not know you were going to be here. He didn't, right? You genuinely did freely choose to attend this evening because God didn't know you were going to in advance, right? Now, this is clearly, for some people, deeply controversial. What do you mean God's all-knowing? Doesn't God know everything? He has to know everything. He has to know the future as well. Well, yes, there's no question that is a very, very standard mainstream view. But there's also, and in this case, you know, genuinely, no question that Ralbug does not believe that, right? This is one of the more controversial aspects of his work. Ralbug is clearly saying, and I intimated this earlier, his Perush on the Torah is consistent with this, right? In his Perush on the Torah, he has the same view and he puts it forward. And it's fascinating to see how he, you know, uses that in the course of his biblical commentary. And I will just note that I did see in one of the comments somebody actually saying this. Here we go. The second comment on the right from somebody from Michael. God doesn't know what's going to happen because in the Torah we see him change his mind. Yes? Okay. So there is, you know, there's warrant from the Tanakh to actually go with this view. Right. Even though many people deem it to be deeply controversial on a pshat reading, right? Pshat in Tanakh is he seems to, you know, God seems to make mistakes and right. He created human beings and it all went horribly wrong. So he had to flood the world and start. Didn't he know that was going to happen? I mean, you know, why bother? Right. So there is warrant. Right. There is warrant for this, even in the Tanakh. But nonetheless, it's still deemed deeply controversial because it seems to have become a standard theological trope. God knows everything. He knows the future. Ralbug here, one might argue, right, is he's just going with pshat. Right. So God does not know the future. Let us continue from nevertheless, right? Because the obvious question here is, hang on, God's meant to be perfect, right? And if God's perfect, he must know everything it's possible to know. So surely, if you say God didn't know you were going to be here tonight, then there's a deficiency in God, right? That's the problem. Right? Pshat in Tanakh isn't such a big deal, right? Plenty of people throughout the ages have not necessarily read the Tanakh in accordance with pshat. There are other ways of reading it, yeah? But God being imperfect? God doesn't know, really? Okay, that is, to certain people, far more problematic. Look what Ralbug says. Nevertheless, the fact God does not have the knowledge of which possible outcome will be realized does not imply any defect in God, may he be blessed. For perfect knowledge of something is the knowledge of what that thing is in reality. When the thing is not apprehended as it is, this is error, not knowledge. Hence, God knows these things in the best manner possible. For he knows them insofar as they are ordered in a determinate certain way. And he knows, in addition, that these events are contingent insofar as they fall within the domain of human choice. As such, knows them truly as contingent. Right? Point being, to know something is to know the truth about it. And if the truth is human beings are free, then for God to truly know it is to know, I don't know, they're free, right? could go either way. So that's initially how he tries to get out of this problem of, hang on, is God perfect? Does, you know, how does that? Surely God must know. He says, well, no, if human beings are genuinely free, and genuine freedom really does mean you could do either or, then for God to have perfect knowledge would be for God to know you can do either or. All right, that's the way that he presents it. What's interesting is there's actually a question of logic that goes all the way back to Aristotle that Rahlbug is here picking up on. And it's just worth thinking for a moment about this particular quasi-logical question, because it helps us to understand many people, like I say, are very uncomfortable with this idea. Right? How can God not know the future? Right? How can God not know even something, you know, easy? Like, you know, I imagine that there are some of you that if I had asked Rabbi Kelman, right, he would have said, you know, I reckon these people will turn up tonight, right? So Rabbi Kelman knows more than God, right? So, you know, many people are uncomfortable to say that we can know as humans more than God can know. So let me try and ease the discomfort somewhat in the following way. Since time immemorial, very, very, very few philosophers have thought that God's omnipotence, like God being all-powerful, means that God can do the literally impossible, right? Could God make, could God create a triangle with internal angles of more than 180 degrees? Okay, can God do that? Now, like I say, the vast, vast majority of thinkers, right, from the most liberal to the most conservative, right, have agreed that he can't. Right? God's omnipotence, God's being all-powerful means he can do everything that it's possible to do, right? Is it possible to split a sea? Yeah. Is it something that happens often? Is it usual? No. But can you do it? Yeah. It's not impossible, right? It is entirely conceivable to split a sea, for example. Is it possible or conceivable to make a triangle with angles of less than or more than? No, it's just not possible, right? The test of possibility here, by the way, just think about whether you can make a movie of it, right? You could make a movie where there's a representation of the sea splitting. You could not make a movie that contained an image of a triangle that didn't have 180 degrees. You can't, right? You couldn't do it because it's not possible. And as I say, thinkers from throughout the ages have been very comfortable saying, yeah, when we say God's all powerful, we don't mean he can do that kind of thing. We just mean he can do anything it's possible to do, right? And like I say, very comfortable with that. The Rambam is a good example. He gives an example of this, right? He says that even God cannot create a square, right, whose diagonal is equal in length to the length of its sides, right? Kind of the mathematical quasi-triangle example I'm giving, right? Okay, everyone's comfortable with that. What about knowledge? Is it possible to know the future? And we're all going to say, yes, of course it is. But maybe it's not. There are those who believe that it's actually not possible to know the future. To know, right? We can make a lucky guess. We can predict, right? I could predict something, but my predicting it doesn't guarantee it. might be very likely, if I know really, really well, right, the causal trajectories and the people involved, yeah, I can likely make a number of correct predictions. It's not knowledge, though, right? It's just, you know, I got lucky, right? Maybe not. Maybe I followed the probabilities. Yeah. But this is the contention of the Rolled Bug, right? Here's an example. Let us now state, I'm going to now state that tomorrow at 6 p.m., it's going to be raining in my town, right? Tomorrow at 6 p.m., it's going to be raining in my town. Now, at 6 p.m. tomorrow, either it will or won't be raining, okay? Here's the question. When I say that right now, when I say it right now, and let's, for the sake of argument, I want you to all kind of, you know, imagine that tomorrow at 6 p.m. it is going to rain, all right? So let's just take that for the sake of argument, right? I say now, tomorrow it's going to rain at 6 p.m. And let's say it does, right? Let's say that's what happens. When I say that now, is it true? Or does it only become true at 6 o'clock tomorrow when it rains? Okay. The question here is, when you make a statement about the future, even if you don't know which of true and false it is it already true at the time you make it or false at the time you make it, right? If I say it rains tomorrow, it doesn't. Was it false when I said it now? Or does it jump become false tomorrow when it happens? Okay, does everybody understand the question here, right? We're asking about statements about the future and whether or not at the moment you make them, they are already either true or false, depending on whether it happens, right? Let's take an example. I'm going to come out of the share for a moment, and let us take a random name here. Okay, so a bunch of names here. So Suzanne, right? Hello, Suzanne. Imagine last week I had said, right, a week ago today, I had said, next week at this time, Suzanne is going to be in the session. Right? Imagine I said that. Now, we know it turned out to be true. Suzanne is here. Was it true when I said it then? Right, that's our question. Even before it occurred and before we knew it was going to, right? The fact it did, was it true when I said it then? There are many logicians who do not believe statements about the future are true or false before they occur, right? When you make a statement about the future, it is neutral. It doesn't have the value true or false at the moment you say it. And if it doesn't have the value of true or false at the moment you say it, then it is quite literally unknowable. At that point, it is unknowable. That's the contention. Let's go back to the shared screen, because you will see that Rolled Bug, Gersonides, in the final quote here, and this is one of his more straightforwardly philosophical works, other than his Peirush on the Torah, and on various Talmudic tractates as well, by the way, and his philosophical work, he wrote some commentaries on works of Arabic philosophy. This is one of his commentaries on a work by Averroes, and look at what he says here. With respect to future contingents, for example, Reuben will go tomorrow, or Reuben will not go tomorrow. Such statements do not divide the true and the false determinately. For in these propositions, one or the other of them will be true, but it's not determinately known now which of them is true. But when the time arrives, one of them is true and the other is false. When the time arrives, one of them is true. Right now, if I say tomorrow it's going to rain in Teaneck at 6 p.m. Right now, that statement is neither true nor is it false. Right? In its very essence, doesn't matter what's going to be, it's neither. And if it doesn't have any truth value, as philosophers say, attached to it, it's unknowable. And therefore, for the Ralbag, the fact God doesn't know the future is not an imperfection. Right? God cannot make a four-sided triangle. It's impossible. Doesn't mean he's not omnipotent. To be all-powerful is to do everything it's possible to do. God is omniscient. God knows everything it's possible to know. It's just that it's not possible to know statements about the future. That's the Ralbag's contention, right? So the Ralbag really does believe that there is a genuine contradiction, right? A genuine tension between divine omniscience and free will. At least divine omniscience as traditionally understood. And he explicitly tells us human beings have free will. God does not know what it is you're going to do. But that does not in any way question God's perfection, because it is literally impossible to know the future, according to the Ralbag. Okay? So, that's the Ralbag solution. As I say, it's still, I think, deemed controversial, was certainly deemed controversial at the time. And just, you know, I'll end with the question, why? Right? Why is it so troubling for God to not know the future? Right? And when I think about it, I'm genuinely not sure. I'm not sure why that's troubling. It might trouble you if God doesn't know the present, right? But to not know the future, why do we worry about that? I think many people worry about it because of the notion of hashgacha, of providence, right? I need to know the future so I can, you know, I guess control it in some way. Actually, knowing the future would be terrible for providence, right? Because if God knows the future, then he can't change it. Right? He can't intervene and do something else because he knows what the truth is going to be. So knowledge of the future, intuitively we feel, is something God must have for whatever reason, despite the fact that, as was pointed out in a comment in Tanakh, it's not clear that's actually pshat, right? But it's definitely become a mainstream view, right? And might indeed be the truth, right? However, always interesting to explore alternatives. And Ralbag gives us one, gives us an interesting one. It's one that may or may not appeal, right? But whether knowledge of the future really is theologically so important is maybe one of the things that his view will cause us to think about a little bit. And maybe with that, I will pause or end and maybe look at some of the chat questions, or if anyone wants to ask anything subsequently or reiterate anything that's here in the chat, I'm happy to take those for however long it is we have.
I would just go through the questions on the chat, I guess, initially.
Okay, so let's have a look here. So the first one, possibly time is not linear for God. Well, the time is not linear for God one is another well-known solution, right? The problem with divine foreknowledge is if God knows before it happens, right, then what I do is determined. But there are people who say, well, there's no before and after for God, right? God is beyond time. So he doesn't know before it happens, so it's okay, right? That is that the kind of solution is that you're referring to? Is that a zahav, it says up there? Yeah. If that's the solution you're referring to, then yeah, that's the solution that's given. Some people think Chasdei Kreskas gives a version of that. Unfortunately, I'm not sure it works, because I don't think it matters when God knows it, right? What matters is it's true. Okay, you know, 2 + 2 = 4. When is that true? There's no when, it's eternal, right? It's outside of time, it's just a truth. And if it's the truth, it can't be any different. So I'm not sure, even though this is a very, very well-known solution, many people give it, right? God is beyond time, so he didn't know beforehand, so it's not a problem. I'm not sure it works. Yeah, I'm not sure it's a good solution, because all you need to stimulate the problem is what God knows is true. That's all you need. Time doesn't really enter into it, right? If God's knowledge is the truth, we have an issue. So I'm not convinced about that solution, though, like I say, it is one that many others give, and others would disagree with me there. And the second point that we mentioned, which is, yes, indeed, in the Tanakh, it's not clear that God has to know in advance. So that's fine. We then have God is all perfect. He can choose not to know in advance regarding human beings' specific actions. So, you know, we've seen Ralbag thinks he doesn't know. For the sake of transparency, Ralbag doesn't think he chooses not to know. Ralbag thinks he just doesn't. That gets into broader questions. But certainly it would be possible, and this is a kind of almost Eliezer Berkowitz view on things, right? Hester upon him. God has to, so to speak, step back in order to allow for human history and human free will, right? So, you know, that's certainly a possible solution, to say that God has, you know, so to speak, chosen to not know, right? In order to allow for human free will in human history. So that's certainly possible, yeah? And then a selfless self, could we God to their actions? How can worship of God be meaningful to God? Indeed, right? Ralbag doesn't have that problem, right? Because God doesn't know, so therefore nothing's determined, and therefore it's real worship. Determinism would cause all manner of problems for human responsibility, correct? This is really why it's such a big problem. According to Rabbi, how can God promise reward for our performance of mitzvot? Because if we do perform mitzvot, we will be rewarded, right? It seems okay if he's not determining what we do, right? If we genuinely have free will, then he'll say, yeah, you know what, if you do this, then you'll be rewarded, right? That seems to be okay. More of a problem if there was no choice there. And yes, this question, if God knows all of the determinants at work, since what he can figure out the future completely. So the whole point is he doesn't, right? He doesn't know all the determinants at work, because genuinely for Ralbag, again, I'm speaking here purely in the name of Ralbag and his view, for Ralbag, he doesn't, right? He knows all the determinants in terms of the heavens and all of that, but that still leaves open what for him is genuine free choice. Yes, the problem here from Zev, if God doesn't know how Kitab Rami's sons will end up in Egypt, is a good question, but is just the flip side of the other kind of Tanakh issue, which is why didn't God seem to know what was going to happen when, right? So you always, in these kind of philosophical discussions, have to engage in some kind of interpretation, some kind of drush. And I guess you pays your money, you takes your choice in terms of which ones you reinterpret. That genuinely, you know, not being facetious, but genuinely is the case with many of the medievals, right? In terms of what it is that one is going to have to reinterpret and what it is that one leaves in place. That is the nature of the beast, I'm afraid. The scientific problem with free will, which I mentioned at the beginning, oh goodness me, I don't know, our regular heart with a minute left, I really can. It's a massive question unto itself. It's something that is very interesting and I have a preferred solution to, but it's not one I'm going to be able to, unfortunately, do so quickly. Please God, maybe one day in the future. God and God choosing not to, is there any philosophical problem with God choosing not to know the future? No knockdown problems, right? As in, I don't think you could argue that it's absolutely incoherent and doesn't work. I'm sure there are people who would give arguments as to why they don't think it does, but I imagine you could give counter arguments as to why you think, right? So I don't think it's an argument that is incoherent, or a view that's incoherent. It's a view that people may be able to argue against, but I imagine one could similarly argue for, right? So I don't, it's definitely not an answer that is in and of itself, you know, simply a non-starter. It's definitely a starter, right? And the question would be how you would respond to the criticisms that might be launched at it. And it, that would be, you know, I'm sure there would be an interesting discussion to be had. Okay.
Thank you very much. very good. Okay, we'll have to pick up another time on the Rambam and the Ravid.
Absolutely. Oh, yes, indeed.
Disagreement and, yes. You know, the Ravid getting mad at the Rambam for raising
the problem. Yeah.
Okay, that's for another share. But really, I want to thank you very much.
And my pleasure.
I enjoyed very much and wish everybody a healthy and happy Pesach and beyond.
Absolutely.
And, even when we get back to normal, we look forward to having classes online, Toronto, Teaneck, Israel, wherever people may happen to be. And I want to wish everybody well. Tomorrow morning, 11 a.m., Dr. Rabbi Ari Zivotofsky on the history of soft and hard matzah. So everybody's welcome to get back in the real Pesach mode. And take a look at your emails for upcoming as we get, you know, obviously we're going to take a break later on in the week and then we'll resume with some online learning. So thank you, everybody. And
have a summer to everybody and be well.
Okay, good night, everybody.
Good night.